majestic Grand Canyon of the Colorado, a fantastic water-cut, mile-deep gorge exposing thousands of feet of the Earth's strata. Countless millions of fossils are preserved in these rocks, mute witnesses of the incredible variety of life forms which have existed on the Earth over the course of time. These fossils tell us a fascinating story about life, death, and believe it or not, about creation. High school and college students studying geology are told the fossil record contains proof that you and I evolved, that we came from lower life forms, that all life, in its fantastic variety, its beauty, its symmetry, its harmony, its interdependency, the fact that life is symbiotic in the sense that nothing really survives all by itself, all that we see about us today in the nature series you might watch on television, of the incredible varieties of life beneath the surface of the sea, living desert, some of the Disney films that tell us about life in ecosystems specially equipped for survival in certain circumstances that just amaze us, that we marvel at as we see the fantastic array of creatures that do exist. All of this is supposed to have evolved over millions of uncounted aeons of time and are supposed to be proof of it in the rocks. Actually, though, the fossil record consists of a whole series of enormous, millions years long gaps with no true intermediate species between any fully developed species. Secondly, in the whole geologic column, there is not one species ever found turning into, even partly, another. That is, with half-developed tissues or organs or scales or feathers or what have you. A continuous chain of fossils showing one species changing into another would be the greatest single discovery of any evolutionary geologist, but none has ever been found. A.S. Rohmer in genetics, a very big name in that field, and it's called Genetics, Paleontology, and Evolution, the entire title of the book, on page 114, said, and I quote, "Links are missing just where we most fervently desire them, and it's all too probable that many links will continue to be missing," stated geologist William Stokes, and I quote, "The fossil record tends to be weakest in those portions that are of most interest to evolutionists, that is, in specimens pertaining to the origin and early stages of individual groups of organisms. Not only the whole problem of the origin of species, but also the appearance of life on the Earth is involved here." So let's take a look at some specific examples. The animals with backbones first appear in the geologic record in great diversity and complete with backbones already present. Earliest fossils show no transition whatever from invertebrate to vertebrate. Of course, a lot of people who believe in evolution would like to find some ancestors for the vertebrates in the fossil record, but here's where the problem comes in. The taro branches, acorn worms, tunicates, and amphioxus, are all modern animals whose structures are such that evolutionists have placed them as forerunners to the vertebrates. They do this because they have a so-called primitive backbone, or notochord, that somewhat resembles the structures of vertebrates. But each is a specialized creature, too specialized to be an actual ancestral form by evolutionary thinking. There is no fossil record whatever of the hypothetical stages in this portion of the evolutionary sequence as it may be pictured in textbooks or drawn on graphs and charts. The fossil record contains no definitive record of any of the so-called primitive vertebrate stages. There is no fossil evidence whatever to warrant belief that any such forms ever existed at any time in the Earth's history. Suddenly, as if out of nowhere, in the upper Silurian strata, as it's called, appear the shell-skinned, jawless fish. They have no fossil ancestors. By theory, there were supposed to be preceding forms, but by fossil evidence, there were none. By general appearance, the armor-plated fish that have jaws would appear to be brothers, and yet there's not a shred or fragment of fossil evidence of a link between the two groups. There is no fossil record of a transition from one to the other. The evolutionist claims there was a generalized ancestor that gave rise to both groups, yet there is not even an indication that any such form ever existed. This is not just faith. Evolution is a faith. It's like a religion. But this is not just faith. It's more like empty hope without anything else to lean upon. One paleontologist, a leading one, Romer, said, and I quote, "In sediments of late Silurian and early Devonian age, numerous fish-like vertebrates of various types are present, and it is obvious that a long evolutionary history had taken place before that time, at least according to him. But of that history, we are still mainly ignorant. The sudden appearance of fish in the early fossil record is a very serious enigma for evolutionists. The crossopterygian, or lobe-finned fishes, appear in the Middle Devonian, but again, there is no fossil evidence of their direct ancestry. And we can see here in this graphic not only the ancient form of crossopterygian fish, but also a living fossil, the coelacanth fish, Latimeria, which was caught in 1939 to the surprise of the fishermen, scientists, evolutionists, and everybody. Actually, this was a bit embarrassing because up to that time, investigators believed that the coelacanth had disappeared millions of years ago during the Cretaceous period, and there is no fossil record of him from what they label the Cretaceous period up until today, and so that's why he was called a living fossil. Said the famous paleontologist Romer, quote, "The appearance of the typical bony fishes in the geologic column is a dramatically sudden one. In the Middle Devonian, however, all the major types, ray fin forms, crossopterygians, and lung fishes, appear full-fledged and diversified and at once dominate the scene." This is a very vitally important point. On the one hand, you see in the record of death in the rocks, sudden burial by a catastrophe, the burial of avalanches of living creatures preserved in fossil form. On the other hand, if you're trying to view it from an evolutionary point of view and look at the life instead of the death aspect of it, you see the sudden appearance of life. You can take it either way. In any event, in either direction, it's a terrible headache for people who wish to explain creation without a creator, life without a life giver, law without a lawgiver, the present operation of all of this symbiotic ecosphere of ours without someone to sustain it, design without a master designer. They try to do this by doing away with the concept of an all-wise divine creator being who has intelligence and actually is and exists and of which we are his handiwork. The only way they can conveniently step aside from responsibility in the face of God's Ten Commandments and His laws is to do away with the idea that there is a God and make God just a nebulous chance strike of electricity in a methane ammonia soup of some sort. Well, you ought to get it proved to yourself, and you can if you'll write for this brochure and others that we have along this line. This one entitled The Origin of Life. Now, the best way to get this, it goes into some of these and other very interesting questions and headaches for evolution, is to dial that toll-free number you see, 800-423-4444. And we'll send it to you by return mail, or not even by return mail, because we'll just get it to you one-way mail the minute we get your telephone call. Oftentimes people call, the lines are busy, keep trying, or call after the program, or jot down the number and call a little bit later. That's 800-423-4444. For those in California, Canada, and elsewhere, just write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California. We'll get it to you by return mail as soon as we can. Another brochure on the same subject is the idea of probability, of chance. What about the old monkey in the typewriter idea, or the dumping of the bricks that might eventually form a wall? What are the chances, mathematically, that evolution could have occurred? These and other questions that are really headaches for evolutionists are covered in those brochures if you will either call right away or write for them. The amphibian links. These are interesting, that evolution claims that the euthynopteran is a link between fish and amphibians. They tried desperately to show that there are certain links. However, this fish was obviously designed for a life in the water. Evolution feels that this fish might have squirmed around on the land with its fleshly armed fins. One of the big questions is, by what law of genetics did the four lobe fins change into 4 feet of an amphibian? The next stage up, as they like to put it, we don't know whether it's up, laterally, or down, but they call it up, is the genus Simoria, which is supposed to be a beautiful intermediary form between the amphibians and the reptiles. But one small problem is that it shows up 30 to 40 million years, the way they themselves arrange geologic time, after the first reptiles. 30 to 40 million years, well, give or take 10 million, you know, what's 10 million or so in geologic time? I mean, you could be a little careless with that. But that's rather embarrassing. If it is supposed to be an intermediary link developing up into these types of amphibian vertebrates, and how in the world did it appear, according to their own reckoning, 30 to 40 million years after the first reptiles? Then evolution also faces the same problem with reptiles themselves. When considering the bona fide reptiles, we find at the same time that as the first so-called simple reptiles appear, other so-called highly specialized reptiles are also present in the record. This is totally contradictory from an evolutionary point of view. So my point is this. When you look at the family tree of the vertebrates, the way evolution tries to arrange it, as you can see in the graphic, we actually have a series of disconnected branches without a trunk. Branches are often shown connected to a trunk by dotted lines, where a relationship is assumed by paleontologists. But the evidence, like I've been showing you, just isn't there. Furthermore, the branches themselves are likewise disconnected. For example, the mammal branch is made up of disconnected groups of organisms. Likewise, rodents, which make up the largest section of the mammals, are also comprised of numerous disjointed branches. Actually, the statement in the book of Genesis that God created plants and animals, fish, humankind, everything is strongly supported by the geologic record, because the geologic record shows sudden, fantastic variety of life forms perfectly equipped to survive, and no intermediate species whatever. Geologists call the earliest strata containing abundant fossils the Cambrian period. The Cambrian strata is generally estimated to be about 500 to 600 million years ago, give or take 100 million or so. Yet, astonishing as it may seem, the Cambrian strata fossils of exceedingly intricate forms of life, they abound with these forms of life, and that includes sponges and over 1,000 species of trilobites, as I showed you a beautiful fossil example a program or so ago. Says Gardner B. Moment, who is a professor of biology, and I quote, "The most surprising fact about the Cambrian is that, with the exception of the vertebrates, there are representatives of all the major groups of animals, protozoa, sponges, coelenterates, annelids, echinoderms, mollusks, arthropods, brachiopods, all were there." That's from his book, General Biology, page 611. In other words, suddenly, in the Cambrian, a vast assemblage of complex living creatures is found. A full-blown, developed armada of sea-bottom life stands plainly revealed before you. There are almost no animal fossils and very few plant fossils before the Cambrian or the Precambrian period. All the complex and hard-shelled animals, such as the trilobites, which appear in abundance at the beginning of the Cambrian, the way they label it, had no predecessors in the Precambrian, and they appear with startling diversity, complexity, and suddenly. Now here you see a chart of the incredible variety of the families in the Cambrian strata, shown in red. Also, we show by these dotted black lines the assumed evolution that was occurring, presumably, in the Precambrian. What you actually have is a large part of the family tree of life that should exist in the Precambrian. Here we have supposed evolution of the radiolarian stock, the forams, the branches of the various kinds of sponges. And then there's the archaeocyathids, which, as you can see, were very abundant in the Cambrian, and which, again, according to evolutionary theory, should have undergone a very extensive diversification before the first fossils. The same is true of corals, of worms, and insects. Of course, there are a wide variety of trilobites, and remember, over 100 genera in the Cambrian, none in the Precambrian. And finally, the same is true for the bryozoans, or bryozoans, better said, brachiopods, mollusks, sea urchins, starfish, sea lilies, chordates, and vertebrates. The vertebrates, of course, are not found in the Cambrian, but when you extrapolate their evolution back from the Ordovician strata, which is just above the Cambrian, you would conclude they should have been present in some form in the Precambrian. But the point is this. You don't find more than some inkling that there might have been life, and I take issue with that because you know what they like to claim they find in the Precambrian rocks? They like to claim they find, and I have never seen an example, a fossil, or even a picture of, would you believe, germs in rocks? I'm not kidding you. They claim that in Precambrian rocks you can find evidence of bacteria. Now, I don't know about that. You have very great difficulty finding evidence of bacteria if you look at a rotten apple. So finding bacteria in rocks, well, that's what evolution claims. They say you can find algae formations and a few worm trails. Now, fortunately, worms leave very small trails, and worms are very soft-bodied, and when rocks that weigh millions of tons are formed and laid and superposed one upon another, there probably aren't very many worm trails that survive. They claim fungi and a variety of microorganisms are available in Precambrian strata. I would defy evolution to show you a fossil sample of a microbe. But maybe they think they can. The LaRousse Encyclopedia of the Earth states, and I quote, "One of the great unsolved mysteries of science is the missing fossil record of life, which supposedly evolved between 600 million and 1,400 million years ago during the late Precambrian. In many places, thick marine sedimentary strata, more than 5,000 feet thick, are known to lie beneath formations containing early Cambrian fossils. Diligent search in these rocks, many of which resemble the fossiliferous beds above them, has failed to reveal the missing record." So the point is, the reason the fossils are missing in the Precambrian is not because men haven't looked.
Get your name on the Plain Truth magazine mailing list today. There's no subscription price. The Plain Truth, a magazine worth sharing.
Why, if scientists have investigated thousands of feet of rocks that should contain fossils, are there no fossils to illustrate intermediate species or these Precambrian developments? Well, they have to come up with theories as to why there aren't any proofs. Here are some of the theories and the objections to those theories. Theory number one is that fossils were destroyed by the metamorphism of the rocks in which they occurred. Objection to this: 90% of the Precambrian rocks are schists, gneiss, and marble, distorted by heat and pressure. But the remaining 10% are not. The remaining 10% ought to contain some missing fossils. When you say 10% of Precambrian rocks, you're talking about a gigantic slice of real estate that embraces the entirety of the Earth. And it ought to contain some fossils, but it doesn't. Theory number two, life only existed in those areas which were metamorphosed. Oh, that's cute. But the objection to that is that this would be very fortunate for the theory of evolution, but it's most improbable due to widespread occurrences of unmetamorphosed areas exposed and were certainly accessible to ocean life and thus ought to contain fossils. Theory number three, there wasn't enough calcium in the ocean for the animals to have shells. Objection. There are calcium layers, well, deposits that would show calcium, meaning limestone, thousands of feet thick, deposited in this same early strata in great abundance. So much for that one. Theory number four. The oceans might have been too acid for calcium to be used for the shells, and thus no trace of the animals was preserved. Objections. The oceans were more likely fresh to begin with, according to evolution itself. Also, siliceous and chitinous skeletons could have been formed and preserved apart from the calcium requirement. Such types are found in the Cambrian rocks. Theory number five, life forms lived only in the upper zones of the ocean at first and had no hard parts. Either they became lazy, grew hard parts, and being heavier, settled to the bottom, or else they found the ocean bottom first and became lazy in this new environment and grew hard parts. Thus, the sudden appearance of fossils. I got to stop to comment that these theories are kind of funny to me because it seems they will go to any lengths to try to explain how those fossils came not to be there. The objection to that one is that for life to spend many millions of years in the uppermost portions of the ocean without finding bottom or finding the shore is nothing short of ridiculous. Even after accepting such an idea, the problem remains as to why, suddenly, many forms of life should take on complete skeletons with no intermediate evolutionary steps. A great number of species occur together with hard shells in the lower Cambrian. All must have then, according to evolution, have learned the secret of suddenly getting a hard shell in a hurry. Maybe they just got a stiff back or a stiff neck and pop, there it was. So, the fifth theory is also completely lacking, not only in fact, but in logic. Theory number six is the Lepalian gap. Fossils of the Precambrian were never preserved, they say. There weren't many sediments being formed then. Well, that isn't true. The Lepalian gap just does not exist. Sequences of sedimentary rock transitional from Precambrian into Cambrian appear present in Australia, the southern Great Basin, British Columbia, the Appalachian region, the eastern Baltic, Siberia, and possibly Africa. In fact, beautiful sequences of continuous deposition from the Precambrian into the Cambrian can be seen at several locations in the Mojave Desert in the basin and the range area of California, just north of Mojave. Theory number seven is the idea of the cropping theory, the evolution of cropping predators, allowing other species to diversify because the predators reduced the population of certain dominant species and thus crowded out other forms of life. Well, the cropping theory is shown in this graphic. It doesn't make sense either, but look at the graphic anyhow. Suppose we had two species called A and B that were living in the same environment. Now, if A was dominant, it might not allow B to develop and be fully represented. Maybe A crowded out B, or A used up most of the nutrients that B needed. In any case, B, which could represent a number of different life forms, is not present in enough numbers to be fossilized very often. But suppose another creature, C, was introduced, which fed on A. Then, according to the theory, the pressure on B would be removed or drastically reduced, and this would allow B to greatly multiply and diversify. So the idea is that in the Precambrian, there wasn't much diversity because certain species dominated the scene. But then with the beginning of the Cambrian, these predatory creatures are introduced. Where they came from, they never try to explain, which is supposed to account for the sudden appearance of a whole host of new and completely different organisms. Objections to this is simple. Destroying one species never produces another. It's just that simple. Destroying one species never produces another. It only allows certain already present species to increase in numbers. Take some of the western states in the United States. Farmers go out and kill off all the coyotes, they've got a fantastic rabbit explosion, or a mice explosion, or something. They go out and kill off all the rabbits, and they find out that suddenly they can't kill off all the rabbits. I mean, the rabbits are almost impossible to kill off. But they find then a rise in other types of pests. So you have this fantastic balance in nature that we deal with every single day today in our own ecosystem. We find where man interferes to try to destroy one type of life that he might feel is a predator, then he is overrun with the kind of creatures the predators fed upon. So the theory that this cropping idea is supposed to purport that could give rise to new species because certain predators were keeping other species down to a bare minimum or practically non-existent is absolutely stupid. It cannot give rise to a new, completely different set of organisms. Theory number eight is eruptive evolution, and this is a real beauty because now evolution really skirts on the edge of danger and tippy-toes across thin ice by dealing with the word eruptive, which means explosive or suddenly. Now, this theory that you might call eruptive evolution says that, quote, for some unknown reason, evolution began to occur at, quote, a feverish rate, end quote, after the Precambrian. And that's why we have the sudden appearance of a plethora of fossils in the Cambrian strata. So what they're really saying is that evolution, according to some of the testimony of the rocks themselves, can appear like a sudden creation. That, boom, all kinds of life forms are available instantly. Of course, evolution is a faith. It is based upon billions of tons of missing evidence. There are no chains. There are a few scattered links which evolution likes to see by analogy in certain vertical forms when, in fact, they might have been lateral. As I said last time, if there would, perish the thought, come a horrible calamity of some sort, which might bury the entire subcontinent of Australia, and you would have on the one hand Sydney, a modern space-age city, complete with all of the fantastic traffic freeway systems, big famous Sydney Bridge and all the rest of it, the buildings, you know, everything that makes up a modern city, and only a few miles, comparatively, out toward the outback of the Blue Mountains, you've got in a number of Aboriginal villages. Now, the whole thing is buried and deposited in thousands of feet thick limestones, and later on, the spade of the archaeologist begins to unearth what was occurring there. They look, they find these Aboriginals dressed in nothing, with Stone Age bows and arrows and boomerangs, and they find, on the other hand, beautiful Space Age Sydney. And so they would arrange these vertically and say there is a missing area there of hundreds of billions of years maybe, or 10 or 20 million years maybe, give or take a few million, and that the one developed from the other, when we know that they coexist. Now, just like creatures coexist today that are called living fossils, like that coelacanth that they supposed was gone, it isn't found from the Middle Devonian all the way until today. Now, the Middle Devonian Age, in the Middle Age, all the way down there, better than halfway through the geologic column in its idea of things, not age-wise, but at least in the way the layers of rocks are superposed one upon another. You have to go backward from the recent or the tertiary, the ice ages, and that's Eocene, Oligocene, Miocene, Pleistocene coming up. And you have to go through these millions upon millions upon millions of years where there isn't a single coelacanth found, and even that entire genera, the entire idea of this kind of a paddle-finned fish is nowhere evidenced in the rocks from that time until today. And lo and behold, some fortunate fisherman, or I guess evolutionists wish the guy had never been born, ends up dragging one of these things out of the sea somewhere near the island of Madagascar in a fisherman's net, or maybe with a hook, I don't know. But then, you know, someday I think they may find some creatures that they think are extinct today and are not. For instance, there was a fantastic story some years ago that was repetitious in True and other magazines. Maybe True magazine is not all that true, according to some people. I wouldn't be able to contest that, but they claimed that they took a whole pig and they had this fishing rod made out of a piece of spring steel. They had this giant drum on the end of some kind of a ship, and they were fishing in one of the deep trenches of the ocean depths with, I believe, the carcass of an entire pig, and they had a gigantic steel hook, and they got a strike on this rig down there thousands of feet, and it broke the line. And the line was a big cable. Well, they speculated it was some kind of a sea monster. They speculated maybe it was an eel or something. And then finally, I believe, an eel was discovered. Don't quote me on how many feet long. I think it was 6 or more feet long, that was supposed to be a larval or a baby stage. And they began to estimate that the adult of that particular species might literally be hundreds of feet long. So they were wondering whether or not this might account for some of the strange sea creatures or sea monsters in tradition and fabled history. Well, it does make you wonder what really does dwell on the bottom of the Marianas Trench or the Japanese Trench in the abyssal depths of the ocean, and whether or not someday we will find that there are, in fact, even trilobites still alive today. That's a question, of course, but I think at least fair to ask, because after all, evolution throws millions of years around with almost no qualms at all. Well, if you were right for this book or this little brochure on probability and what it says about evolution, and also this one on the origin of life, we'll send it to you by return mail free of charge. Until next time, Garner Ted Armstrong. Goodbye, friends.
You have seen Garner Ted Armstrong. For literature offered on this program, send your request to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Canadian viewers write Box 44, Vancouver, BC. Or in the continental United States, you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444.